This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Today's guest, a bioethicist, and she'd like you to re-examine your attitude toward animals. But first, I need to ask, have you ever had what you consider to be an extraordinary relationship with a pet? One where you felt you could communicate with that animal to a degree others consider not possible? Rosalind Byrne says she's had that and more. A few years ago, this scholar, long respected in her field, began talking with horses and says they communicated back. This hour, we examine her new book about that experience, talk with other people who've witnessed the experience, and then circle back to the original issue. No matter what you think about talking with animals, is it possible that rethinking how humans view animals is something worth considering? Your view will certainly be welcome when our conversation with the author of When the Horses Whisper begins right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Our fundamental question this hour, a pretty simple one. What are animals for? But to fully consider the question, we're going to travel what for most people will be a rather unusual route. Our guest is a bioethicist who has researched and taught that subject for some 15 years now in her role as a faculty member at the University of Virginia's School of Engineering. She's also written extensively on that subject, but her newest book, just out this month, is certain to be a surprise to most of her students and her colleagues. It is titled When the Horses Whisper. Dr. Rosalind Byrne, welcome to the Insight Studio.
Thank you. What a delight to be here with you, Tom.
Well, Rosalind, before we get to this development in your life that I understand started about 3 years ago and that is documented in this just-released book, I was wondering if we could talk first about your career as a bioethicist.
Sure. Yeah. Well,
so what is a bioethicist and how did you become one?
Bioethicist is someone who asks questions about what is right and good, questions about moral choices and quandaries and difficulties that come either in the field of medicine and medical practice or biotechnology, which has been my most recent interest. It came for me, actually, because of a personal experience. I was almost full term with a pregnancy that I realized through a dream was problematic. And it turns out that my daughter...
Well, let me make sure I understood what you just said.
Uh-oh.
You had a dream that told you there was something wrong with this pregnancy.
That's right. At 38 weeks gestation, I had a dream.
And then what did you do?
Woke up in the morning and called my obstetrician, told him about the dream and that I needed to see him as soon as he could possibly work me in. And he got me in that afternoon, told me not to worry. It was anxiety about the impending delivery. And I said, I really think not. So he did an internal exam and his face dropped and he sent me to have an x-ray, which you don't really do on a healthy child. And the diagnosis was anencephaly, meaning without brain. That evening, I got on the phone to the University of Virginia medical. There's an organ donor line that I called, and one thing led to another. I was knowing that she would be born without a brain. I was very anxious to get her organs donated
because you knew moments after she was born, she would die.
Yeah, absolutely. It turned into a very complicated process. There was one protocol for that through Loma Linda Hospital in California. The University of Virginia was willing to work with me to go through that protocol. At the end of the day, something else very interesting happened. During the delivery, it was a very, very serious problem because she got stuck behind my pelvic bone because there wasn't enough pressure from the formation of the skull because there was no skull. There was just soft tissue. So I had an awareness and cried out, the baby will be born at 3:12 p.m. And she wasn't. She was born at 5:20, but 3 days later, she died at 3:12 p.m. After that whole experience, the fact that we couldn't donate her organs because we were told of ethical problems, I wanted to understand what happened, what just happened. I was trying to do the right thing, and I was told maybe it wasn't the right thing because of ethics. So I went back to school, got a PhD in bioethics. Now I understand.
Why wasn't it the right thing?
Well, the thing about ethics that makes it such a fascinating field is that a true ethical quandary is one where you both ought and ought not do the same thing. So it would have been the right thing to donate her organs, and it also would have been the wrong thing to donate her organs, depending on how you see it, depending on your principles, depending on your beliefs. And that's what makes the field so fascinating, is it's not really clear when something is right and something is wrong. We have to really struggle through and work through and think through and have a process to help us. In the case of Zoe, my daughter, it would have required putting her on, well, she actually did go through the beginning of the protocol where they put her on pretty intensive life support systems in order to maintain her organs until her brain waves decreased to such an extent that they could ethically remove the organs and consider her close enough to dead or dead. It's very tricky. So the question was, is it right to take the organs of a newborn child who's about to die if she's not completely all the way dead as we measure it? Now, in the old days, before we had the technology to measure brainwave activity, we would just take a reading on the heart-lung function. If the heart stopped and the lungs stopped breathing, we would pronounce a person dead. We don't do that anymore because we have the technology to pick up the activity of the brain. And because of that, she could not be pronounced dead when she stopped breathing and when her heart stopped. So they had to activate life support to maintain her breathing and her heart and wait for her brainwave to go. So the question, is it right or is it wrong? Was she dead or was she alive? Should we take the organ? Shouldn't we? Took us into the world of ethical quandary.
So you ended up with a career as a scholar of bioethics. You got your PhD in the late 1990s, and you have been teaching in what is sort of a kind of liberal arts department within the School of Engineering at the University of Virginia, which also is your alma mater. And that school is called, or that department is called?
We are the Program of Science, Technology, and Society in the Department of Engineering and Society.
And before you got to that, where you're now a professor in that department, have been since shortly after getting your PhD, you had several other careers. I mean, after you, what, first finished your master's at UVA in the early 80s, you set up your own business as a sort of public speaking consulting business?
I did that for a couple of years during that terrible recession when it was so hard to find work. I thought, well, then I'll employ myself. I have some skills here.
And your original degrees, your undergraduate degree, your master's degree, were in communications?
They were. That's right. They are.
And then for many years, you were the director of admissions at the Darden School of Business at the University of Virginia?
I was, recruiting MBAs and reading their applications and interviewing them. And I spent about a decade at Darden. I also taught business ethics while I was there.
And then for a time, you headed up a private school in the Charlottesville area.
Yes.
Is it called Tandem Friends?
Exactly. I was the head of school at Tandem Friends.
And that was when you had this pregnancy that resulted in your daughter being born?
Tandem came after. Zoe was born while I was still at the Darden School.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. My other children, Ari and Kaya, were born just before I went to Tandem. So I went to Tandem with an infant and a toddler at home.
Okay, so Rosalind Byrne, we've got you to the point now where you've told us how bioethics became so important to you that researching it and teaching it became a career for you. And it's a career that you've been involved in for almost 15 years as a faculty member in this program called Science, Technology, and Science.
And Society.
Science, Technology, and Society. That would make more sense, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
At the School of Engineering at the University of Virginia. And you've written books about bioethics, particularly as it applies to new technologies?
Yes. Well, the first book that I did in that field was about nanotechnology, which is manipulating at that scale of 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter, and that was called Nanotalk, where I interviewed scientists, 35 of them, who were working in that field and looked at questions of ethics related to their work.
And you've written any number of scholarly articles?
Yes, I have.
From the colleagues of yours that I've spoken with at the University of Virginia? You're frowning. You didn't know I did this. I did. I got all kinds of glowing reports about your work, some of whom said when I told them about your newest book, well, if Roz says that's what happened, then that's what happened. And others just kind of sighed and went, oh my, has she gone off the deep end? So let's get to your newest book.
Following up, I'm not sure if you talked to my department chair, but I had an extraordinary conversation with him. I went to tell him about this book because, in fact, it really does take me out of the academy as a scholar in terms of writing. And he said, when I told him, sort of as a fair warning, this is coming out. He said, did you write it thoughtfully? And I said, I did my best. He said, was your heart in it? I said, more deeply than anything I've ever written. And he said, then you have no choice. So here we are. I had no choice.
The incident that was followed by many others that led to this book happened a little more than 3 years ago?
Yes, about September, 3 years ago. Mm.
And this was something of a difficult time in your life to begin with.
Mm.
Tell us about that.
Well, it was about 6 months after the end of a 30-year marriage. I was living on my own for the first time since marriage. I was working in a very, very stressful job. I needed to sort of figure out, where am I now in my life? And, what's important to me? Where am I going? And I was really quite emotionally exhausted. So I took a vacation and took myself to Costa Rica. I'd been there with my marital family, but I'd never traveled like that, quite like that alone. Found a cabin retreat in the northern part of Costa Rica near the volcano Arenal, and I sat for 5 days working on a novel that I was trying to finish and just sort of coming to terms with where I was in my new life and trying to heal.
An important part of the description of where you were was that they had trail horses there.
That's sort of one of the reasons people go to that particular place, is because of those trail horses and their work with equine therapy. I had not gone there with that purpose. I'd gone there just to have a place to be alone, a place of beauty where I could feel more of my connection with the planet and its beauty. But on the fifth day, I thought, I better get out of this cabin and put these papers down and get some fresh air and just see what's there. So I got on a horse. The owner of the retreat took me and two other tourists who were there. The four of us rode for the better part of an afternoon. It was very peaceful, very beautiful. At one point, we crossed a river, and I thought, oh, wow, I've never crossed a river on a horse before. And we were the last. I was on a horse named Titan, and we were the last to cross. And Titan ever so slightly slipped on the bank coming up on the other side of the river, and I fell off into the river.
I think we've just got enough time before the break. If you would read from your book, When the Horses Whisper, where you describe what happened next in this incident.
Sure. Titan and I cross last, and he steps gingerly over the rocky bottom. The other horses and their riders are already on the other bank when Titan and I make it across. Steady and sure-footed, he places one front hoof up onto the muddy side, but his rear hoof hits a loose rock. He trips and recovers quickly, but suddenly I'm off his back and under the water. As I stand up, soaked head to toe and laughing, Titan looks back at me with embarrassment. I can see in his eyes and in his bearing that he's apologetic and ashamed. The horses are tied up, and we riders eat lunch and play in the river for a while. I find an eddy to sit in to enjoy a gentle water massage. From there, I watch Juan Jose, one of the guides, as he plays. He climbs up onto a tree, grabs hold of a hanging vine, and swings himself into a deep pool in the river.
Okay, so I'm going to have to pause there. I'm sorry, I misgauged the time. The most important paragraphs of this selection in the book, When the Horses Whisper, are going to come up in just a bit more than 1 minute. Our guest on Virginia Insight, bioethicist Rosalind Byrne. Her newest book is titled When the Horses Whisper. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham, and I'm the one who misgauged the time before we went into that break. So we were in the middle of an all-important selection early in this new book of Rosalind's. Rosalind, would you just pick up where you left off for anybody who's just joined us? This particular story is happening while you're on a vacation, a kind of personal retreat in Costa Rica. You're at the, I think it's called Leaves and Lizard Retreat, which has trail horses in Costa Rica. You've been riding the horse Teton. He stumbled going across the water. You fell into the water. You were laughing. Later in the day, this description comes in your book.
The whole experience is otherworldly, so very far away from the life I am living back home. I feel joyful and totally relaxed. When it's time to return to the cabin retreat, I climb onto Teton for the ride back. And that's when I clearly hear Teton speak. I don't mean that I interpret the look in his eyes or read his body language or assign some meaning to his actions. I actually hear him explain how bad he felt for failing to carry me safely. Not with words, of course, but through some other kind of communication. Teton is definitely speaking. It is as if something has opened inside of me, making it possible for me to hear him. All the way back from the river, Teton continues talking, mostly about how he is concerned about whether I am okay, how humiliated he is, and how he has never before fallen with a rider, let alone caused a rider to fall off his back. Just before arriving at the stable, I hear him say, "By the way, I don't need any more training. Would you please tell that to Debbie?"
Debbie is the owner of this horse farm and retreat. And Debbie also is the owner of Teton and many other horses there. Did it occur to you that when you fell off the horse, maybe you hit your head and you were now hallucinating things?
I wondered, except that Debbie asked me how I could possibly know about the fact that she and the stablemen for the last few weeks had been discussing sending Teton back into training. So the possibility that I had some kind of brain damage sort of was lessened by her.
You actually went to Debbie after this trail ride ended.
Well, Teton asked me to.
Do you realize how that sounds?
That's why I'm laughing.
Are there any number of people who are listening saying, you know, if I was riding a horse and I could have sworn the horse was talking to me and asked me to give a message to the owner, I don't know that just because I heard him ask me, I would necessarily go to the owner and say, this is what your horse has been telling me.
Can I be really silly for a moment?
Please.
Wilbur. Now, I loved that show. Poor Mr. Ed. Everybody laughed at him. It was a silly show. It was silly. We were making fun of that possibility. But maybe we're in a new place now. Maybe we're in a place where we're willing to ask questions about our connection with other species. Was it silly to go to Debbie? What was I thinking? Wouldn't I have wanted to hide that and be embarrassed? Maybe at some point earlier in my life. Not now. Not now. Because I feel like it's time to trust. I've had too many life experiences to tell me, don't just assume that we understand everything. We're still fairly limited in our capacities to measure and understand the physical universe. We have tools. We're coming along nicely. We can measure at the nanoscale now. We can pattern the brain. There's a whole new field of cognitive science that's doing incredible research, neuroscience, things we never could fathom before we're starting to understand. Why isn't it possible that there's more for us to learn? So I'm trusting myself here. I'm going to Debbie. I'm trusting myself. I'm thinking, what's the worst thing that could happen? She laughs. I can handle that. She didn't laugh. She stood back. She was a little worried about the other tourists hearing. But she came to me later that night and said, I need to talk to you. I need to tell you that we've been discussing this, and I'm really startled that you know. How do you know? I said, Debbie Teton told me. I don't understand how. The next morning at breakfast, she came again, and she said, I'm having a lot of trouble with a horse named Etana. She's my favorite horse, but I might have to get rid of her if we can't figure out what's wrong. Please, do you think you could help me? She was moving to a place of trying to trust, as I was trying to trust and try to understand. As I said earlier, Tom, it's as if I don't have a choice. I'm trying to be scientific and to be critical and thoughtful. But inside of me, I have to trust who I know myself to be. And this is why I'm being relatively fearless.
So Debbie asks you to go and see if you can communicate with this other horse.
Yes, she does.
And what happens?
So I don't know what I'm doing. This is new to me. I stand next to Etana.
And Etana?
Etana is her name. I say, Etana, Debbie is concerned about you. You're bucking and you're kicking and you're having trouble on the trail rides. She's had to take you off. She'd like to know what's wrong. Etana stands there as if she doesn't hear anything. And I think, what am I doing? This is just ridiculous. But then, you know, this part of me, this little small voice inside of me says, don't give up yet. So I whisper into Etana's ear and I say, Debbie tells me that she might have to get rid of you. Please let me know what's going on. Etana then turns herself completely around and puts her jaw on my shoulder, opens her eyes, and I hear her say, what did you just say? And we go from there. And she explains to me what's happening. And I tell Debbie what Etana has said. Debbie does what she's been asked.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. First, she explained to me that she's exhausted from her responsibility for the herd and she needs to be separated from them for a while. I had never heard of the term lead mare, but apparently that was her role, which means she was responsible for the herd. Then she showed me her GERD underneath her stomach area, and said that she was very concerned about what was going on.
Showed you in terms of mentally
a vision, yeah.
Sent you a picture.
She did. And Debbie said she didn't know what I meant, what was possibly wrong. Then she showed me a field where she wanted to be left alone for a while, away from the herd. So Debbie and I went looking, and I saw it. And it was on the other side of a fence. And Debbie said, she's been trying to open this gate for weeks. We keep trying to reinforce it. I said, well, that's because she needs to be there. 2 weeks later, I'm back home in Virginia, and Debbie called me, and she said, well, as it turns out, Etana was pregnant. We did not know it. She lost the baby. It was a complicated pregnancy. This, Tom, is why Etana needed to be away. She needed to focus on what was going on in her uterus and to take care of with the baby, and she couldn't do that and be responsible for the herd. It was the beginning of my learning to trust and to open up to the possibility that this was truly happening.
And you've had, as you report in your book, When the Horses Whisper, many, many, many conversations with other horses since then.
Yes, I've been back to that same place in Costa Rica and now conversed with all of the herd. And then in Virginia, I've had an opportunity to meet horses at two farms in Nelson County.
Tell us about that.
One farm is owned by a woman named Priscilla Friedberg, and Priscilla actually boards horses for people. She also takes on retired horses who are no longer able to be ridden. It's sort of their final place before they pass. I met Priscilla at a dinner party, and I mentioned to her what I had experienced in Costa Rica and told her I was wondering whether that was just there or something about my state of mind there or those horses, and she's invited me to come to her farm.
Oh, wait a minute. Let me back up here again. You have been a scholar at a highly respected institution, actually highly respected school within a highly respected institution, School of Engineering, University of Virginia. You've published scholarship on bioethics, particularly as it relates to new technology that has been well received. And now you walk up to a lady who has a horse farm in Nelson County and say, oh, by the way, I can talk to horses?
Not quite like that. I see where you're going. and I see what you're asking. I understand. The question is, how am I able and willing to step out of one world and into another? Step out of the world of a scholar, an academician, a thought person who writes things critically into a world
where there's going to be a fair amount of skepticism about anything that sounds paranormal.
That's right. There is going to be a fair amount of skepticism. There's always been skepticism when we've been on the brink of new understandings. And we'll name this paranormal now, but we might not name it so 50 or 100 years from now.
So I guess there's so many questions, and I really am not trying to be disrespectful, but I'm also trying to put myself in the place of anybody listening who's saying, just who is this lady and what's she about and how is she doing these things, or how is she approaching what she says is happening in her life? So tell us at least how you approached Priscilla Friedberg, the lady who owned the horse farm in northern Nelson County.
With a little bit of feeling shy, we were at a dinner party, a birthday party for a mutual friend, and she said she needed to excuse herself and leave early because she needed to get back and feed her horses. And I said, you have horses? And she said, yes. And I said, well, I don't know quite how to explain this to you, but I seem to have acquired a gift, an ability recently to understand horses. How would you feel about me visiting with your horses on your farm? What she said is, I've had somebody come by before who communicated with horses. Sure, come by. We went from there. Now, Priscilla is also a reasoned person. She used to run the Waldorf school. We have that in common. So I think that the fact that she opened her home and farm to me was very trusting on her part, very open, and I much appreciated it.
Among Rosalind Byrne's previous books are the titles Nanotalk, Conversation with Scientists and Engineers about Ethics, Meaning, and Belief in the Development of Nanotechnology, as well as Science Fiction, Nanoethics, and the Moral Imagination. But it is her newest publication, a memoir of sorts, that we are focused on this hour. And this new publication is the book titled When the Horses Whisper. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham, and I think we have Priscilla Friedberg from northern Nelson County on the phone line with us. Priscilla, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Were you on hold long enough there to hear a little bit about what Rosalind was saying?
Yes.
So tell us what happened when she came to your farm.
I had several horses in the barn waiting for her, and we just went down the line speaking to one horse after another. And I didn't tell Rosalind anything about the individual horses aside from their names. And with each succeeding conversation, I was completely blown away by the accuracy of what each horse was telling her. It was very, very specific to each individual horse, and there was no way that she would have had any idea about the things she was saying unless that horse was telling her.
Can you give us an example?
My personal horse is named Blue Star. He's 12 years old, and the only person who's ridden him since he was two. And each horse had an opportunity to just tell Rosalind whatever they wanted, and then I or the horse's owner would have the chance to ask questions. And I chose to tell Blue Star. He's been a very rambunctious horse in his life. He's enormous, and he likes to buck, which I'm getting a little older, and I would just as soon not do all the time. They're not mean bucks. They're just excited and happy and full of energy. So I asked Rosalind to tell him I would really prefer it if he didn't do that all the time, that it scared me. And he seemed surprised and said, well, don't you trust me? And I said, well, actually not entirely. So I would just prefer you to stop doing it. And I'm telling you, this has been going on for the better part of 10 years. It's amazing. I've never been hurt, but most horses, if they are a young horse who bucks, they stop after 4 or 5 years old. So we're getting 10 years old, and he thinks it's quite fun. So sure enough, in the week following Rosalind's visit, he stopped barking. And this was absolutely an amazing event for me to be able to let my guard down and just enjoy riding him without riding defensively. It was
Priscilla Feardbig, I apologize for interrupting you, but you can probably understand, Priscilla, that anybody who hasn't met Rosalind, who hasn't read her book, who hasn't witnessed what you have, is going to be a little bit credulous about the idea that somebody who's worked in this field of science for so long all of a sudden has developed an ability to talk to horses and have them communicate back.
Sure.
So it sounds to me like what you're saying is that this experience with this one horse who's your personal horse, where Rosalind had a conversation explaining that you wanted him to stop bucking, he stopped bucking, is one instance of proof to you that something real was going on in this communication. But you say that there also were several other instances where Rosalind reported back a communication she had with one of the horses that lives at your farm, and it seemed to you like what she was saying had to be right on target.
Well, I'll quickly tell you two others that were also amazing. One was a very young horse who told her that he did not want any more surgery or medications. And Rosalind looked at me and the owner and said, "How does this young 3-year-old horse even know the word surgery?" Of course, that was a wonderful question. And we said, well, because as a newborn foal, he had a birth defect, and he, in fact, had surgery and spent the early part of his life in hospitals with a lot of medication.
Okay, Priscilla, I'm going to stop you right there. And I apologize that our cell phone connection is not that good, and it's a little hard to understand some of what you are saying, but you certainly have given our audience something to think about, and I thank you for doing that.
Yes, indeed.
Rosalind Byrne, bioethicist, author of this new book, When the Horses Whisper. Before we hit the next break, what do you want to add in here?
About what Priscilla is saying?
Mm-hmm.
I'm feeling a little tearful at the moment. It feels like deep heart work for me, which is very different from my academic work, which I'm happy to do it and my heart's in it, but this feels like something that I'm being asked to do, and I don't know how to explain that. But I feel humbled when I hear her speak. I feel in awe because I don't know where it's coming from. It's a mystery to me, but I feel committed to continue because I feel that it's going to help tremendously horses to be well cared for and understood, and help in the relationship between horses and people.
And my sense is, from reading your book and from having talked to you in the past, Rosalind, that there's something more here than just horses. That what you're really after, whether people have a hard time with the story that you're telling about this new gift that you say that you've acquired, or not, you really want to get us rethinking our attitude towards all animals?
And possibly towards our existence as a species on this planet.
We're going to continue our conversation with bioethicist Rosalind Byrne. And actually, soon on the phone line, I think we'll have another horse farm owner who has had experiences with Rosalind. All that in a bit more than 1 minute. Rosalind Byrne is an associate professor of science, technology, and society in the School of Engineering at the University of Virginia. Her new book is titled When the Horses Whisper. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. You didn't want to write this book.
I resisted. That's right.
And when you found a publisher, you asked the publisher if you could have it published under a pseudonym?
I asked him. I did. I thought it would be too risky to write it under my known name. But he said, no, I really would need to, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to need to use the name people know you by. It's going to give us credibility. So I had to decide whether I was willing to do it. And I definitely resisted. But I'll venture to say that I do have what I consider an inner life, and I do receive guidance through prayer, and it was pretty clear to me I was being asked, and I wanted to say yes to this project.
How are you feeling about it at this moment?
A little bit like a deer in headlights, but I'm trusting. I'm just trusting.
What do you hope that anybody who picks up this book and reads it is going to get out of it?
Now that is a wonderful question. Well, a lot of us have animals in our homes and in our lives, or we have had them or know people who do. For one, I would like us to all take a closer look at who these creatures are that we've come to cherish, and ask ourselves, who are they and what do they need? Because they serve us so well and so heartfully, and there's so many stories in our history about sacrifices that animals have made, dogs, horses, others. Just to ask, you know, where are we now in this relationship with these other species, and what more can we learn to really develop and refine that relationship for true understanding, true appreciation, mutuality, not just for our benefit.
So to you who are listening, if you've been with us since the top of the hour, you heard me ask at the very beginning if you had a pet, and if you've ever had a relationship with a pet where you felt like there was a deep ability to communicate. Certainly we've all heard of people saying that they've had that kind of relationship and that they understand that we live in a culture where most people have trouble believing that such a relationship is possible unless you've had one. So to you who are listening, I'm curious if you are that person who has had one and if you'd be willing to tell us about it, or if you just have a question for bioethicist Rosalind Byrne. We are at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Or you can reach us on Facebook, where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Reaching us now by phone is a woman who's well known in the fox hunting community in Virginia, but also well-known internationally as a mystery writer, and it's a good chance you there listening may recognize her most for that. Rita Mae Brown from Afton, Virginia, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Thank you.
So, Rita Mae, you've had some experience with Rosalind Byrne?
You know, I did, and it was wonderful, and it was like having a party in the barn. And the horses were hosting it. It was wonderful.
Now, as I understand it, you have a farm. Is it called Tea Time Farm?
It is, because my family always stopped at 4 o'clock to drink tea.
And it's more than 500 acres?
Yes, it is.
And you have 40 horses on that property.
Yes,
and
many.
About 3 months ago, Rosalind came into, and you took her to one barn where there were 8 horses.
Well, I just thought she was going to talk to one, you know. She wanted to come by because I'd read her book, and she was very kind. And I said, you don't have to do anything. It was a wonderful book. I was thrilled to read it. But she wanted to give back, so she came to the barn, and we had selected a horse for her to talk to. Well, they all started talking. And so she had conversations with each of them and told me what they were thinking. And she couldn't have made it up because it was very specific stuff that only I would have known.
So, you've told me before, Rita Mae, that your impression of Rosalind is she is who she says she is and she does what she says she does.
Oh, very much. And very unaffected by her. I mean, you know, she's big beans over there at UVA, but she's, you know, she's just, in a way, she's almost one of the horses. She's like one of the girls, you know? And it was great because when, you know, I knew a little bit about her and I thought, oh gosh, I'm going to be dealing with this scientist here. She was great.
There are people who have had relationships with horses. Often jockeys talk about a sense of a telepathic communication with the horses that they ride in races. And even those of us who are not horse people have certainly heard stories from people who have a relationship with a horse where they feel like there's this sense of communication between the two of them. And I'm wondering, Rita Mae, if you're just so used to that the idea of Rosalind coming to your place and saying, I can actually talk to the horses and receive very specific messages back, does not surprise you. Because you don't sound surprised.
No. But, I mean, I grew up with horses and hounds. I mean, I've never seen anyone work the way Rosalind does. But, no, I wasn't surprised. And, I mean, there was a horse, Mr. Pip, who's kind of the class clown. And my God, I mean, he just rattled on and wanted to be the center of attention, and it took a little while to shut him up, and he just went wild when she came into the barn. He was so thrilled.
Do you remember Rosalind Byrne, anything in particular about that experience?
He's very playful and very entertaining. I do remember that experience, but I was also feeling what was going on with all the other horses at the same time. I can't give specifics, but he distinguished. He certainly distinguished.
Yeah, they were all talking at once.
Once they got started, they all had some. It takes a while for the horses to realize that this is actually possible, that they can open and trust and open that channel. But once they do, actually my daughter, who's a photographer, she was in the barn that day, and she noted to me later, she said, once one started, all of them got very still and very focused. And it's like then the flow was happening.
Rita Mae Brown from Afton, Virginia, famous worldwide as a mystery writer, well known throughout Virginia for your work in promoting kill-free fox hunting. Thank you so much for making time for us on Virginia Insight.
Thanks, Rita.
Thank you, and I hope everybody listening buys Rosalind's book because it's fascinating.
The full title of the book we've been discussing, When the Horses Whisper, The Wisdom of Wise and Sentient Beings. Its author, Rosalind Byrne, is our guest. If you want to talk to her, you can reach us at 888-WMRA-TALK here on Virginia Insight. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. We're going next to Newmarket. Diane, thanks for dialing in. Your question or comment, please.
I would like to comment that it is such a delight to hear someone with such an extraordinary academic and scientific background speak to this. I'm a dog trainer, and I have my whole life this ability with dogs, but have buried it because of the possibility of ridicule. And to hear her speak about this experience in a way that I so fully understand is just wonderful to me. And I just wanted to thank her for her publication and making more people aware that this possibility exists for everyone if they would only open themselves to it.
I'm so glad you're calling in. Let's hope that the day will come soon where none of us will have to bury these abilities and we can all talk openly and share our stories with one another. Can't you imagine how wonderful it would be for the animals when we're able to do that?
Absolutely. And again, it is a privilege to speak with you, and I applaud your work. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So to you who are listening, we only have a couple more minutes to take calls at 888-WMRA-TALK. We're getting some more in now as they're being processed, or look, there's one where the cell phone line just dropped out. So we still have some lines open, but we started with this fundamental question. I'd be interested what you have as an answer and response. The question is, what are animals for? 888-967-2825. And Rosalind Byrne, if anybody's ever thought about that question before, you'd kind of like them to rethink their answer?
Well, I think we've always thought of animals as our being owned by us, being there to serve us. I actually think that animals are larger than that. I think that the concept of property is probably misplaced. They are companions. They've made all kinds of sacrifices in being domesticated in order to come to us and be with us, support us, care for us. I just learned yesterday that some insurance companies are now covering equine therapy because it's so effective in helping children heal from various traumas.
So this is therapy for humans using horses.
Yes. So how profound is that? That animals are so able to be with us. I mean, we use them for sniffing out drugs. We now use them for sniffing out cancer. They've been tools for us for all kinds of occupations, whether it's dog sledding or horse racing or entertainment. But they also are simply with us in such a deep and measurable way. What if we truly knew what they needed? And we could ask, how can I support you? How can I be there for you so that our relationships are truly mutual?
Next to Middlebrook, Arthur, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment, please, for bioethicist Rosalind Byrne.
A brief comment. I'm an attorney and never believed much in things like horses and people communicating until I had horses and saw them communicating with each other silently and by some force that we have not been able to determine or measure. But it was very clear, very evident that they were communicating with each other and that they also sensed what we were thinking many times. And I think it's paralleled with human beings, but I think it's something that is like magnetism. You can't see it. And for many years, I'm sure people thought it was a mysterious force, but then we learned how to measure it. And I think that at some point we'll be able to do the same with this form of communication between horses and between human beings.
I think you're absolutely right. I agree with you. So glad you're calling in.
Arthur, thanks so much
for your
call. You report in your new book, Rosalind Byrne, When the Horses Whisper, that the horses, or at least one horse in particular, told you you had to write this book.
Not so much as a command, but it was, yes. She told me it was really important that I had been chosen by the horses to do this.
And this
was
among this group of horses,
yes,
that were the started in Costa Rica.
Mm-hmm.
What was the horse's name who said this
to you? That's Beauty. Yeah.
Tell us more about that.
Oh. In fact, there's a section in the book called Beauty Speaks on Behalf of All Horses. She called to me and she asked me to go by myself back to the cabin to sit quietly and to receive her message and to write it down. And she said, we've picked you. We're asking you to do this. It's time. It's time for these understandings to come to human beings about who we are and the fact that we are evolving together into new ways of understanding, new consciousness. And we're asking you to help us in this way.
And what is it that Beauty told you that horses want?
Well, she said that just as humans are starting to have new understandings, new awarenesses about who we are, that so are horses starting to sort of wake up to become more conscious, and that the more they wake up, the more they're going to expect a different kind of relationship with human beings, and that change was imminent, and that humans were going to soon find that horses were just a little bit less willing to participate without a true connection, a true awareness of connection, and that it's time for us to recognize that we're growing together, that we have things to learn together, that we're here together, that the interspecies relationship is going to be very important for our growth.
This all started a little bit more than 3 years for you when you went on this retreat to Costa Rica where they had these trail horses. How is your life different now than it would have been if you'd never had this experience, Rosalind Byrne?
Well, I had an experience of being on an 8-day equine therapy program. They'd brought me in as their horse communicator, but as it turns out, the therapy was for me too. I learned a tremendous amount riding Conan on those 8 days about the need to let go of a sense of control, that it's a bit of an illusion in our lives to think that we are so much in control. And when I was able to do that, and it took some doing, and it was quite a difficult trek emotionally, but when finally I had released, completely released and let go, I felt a sense of exhilaration and peace and joy as I've never experienced before, and that has largely stayed with me.
Would it be fair to say it's taken a fair amount of courage for you to do this?
Not for me to say. It's not a word I would use. I just feel like it's what I'm supposed to do. I saw a sign on a wall in Atlanta that said, "Be the voice for those who cannot speak." It was from the World Wildlife Fund. I feel like I was supposed to see that. I feel like that's what I'm doing.
Our guest has been Rosalind Byrne, bioethicist, professor of science, technology, and society in the School of Engineering at the University of Virginia, and author of the new book, When the Horses Whisper. Rosalind, thank you so very much for your time.
Tom, delight for me. Thank you.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And when you get to that page, you will find more information about the work that Dr. Byrne is doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.